to Current Affairs. My name is Nathan Robinson. I am the editor-in-chief of Current Affairs magazine. I'm joined today by Jonathan Kozol. He is one of the country's leading critics of the education system, writers on education for decades now. He has been writing on the public school system and apartheid schooling in America. He is the winner of the National Book Award, the author of such books as Savage Inequalities, Amazing Grace, The Shame of the Nation, and most recently, a summation of his critique, An End to Inequality, Breaking Down the Walls of Apartheid Education in America. Jonathan Kozol, thank you for joining us on Current Affairs today.
Hi, Nathan. It's great to be with you. If I may, I'd like to start right in by just giving you a sense of the essence of my new book.
Sure.
By saying that the public schools in the United States today are an ethical embarrassment and a betrayal of democracy, not only because of the glaringly unequal way we fund our public schools in the United States, but more to the point, at this moment of so much racial tension in America, because of the seemingly eternal segregation of the schools and the brutalizing toll this takes on Black and Latino children for no fault of their own. With school segregation right now at its highest level since the early 1990s, the nation has eviscerated the legacy of Brown versus Board of Education and ripped apart the dream of Dr. King. And let me just go on a bit more to say that apartheid education, to me, it's like the big white elephant in the middle of the room that we pretend that we can't see. None of the cycles of highly publicized urban school reform that come and go from year to year and temporarily make the headlines, none of these reforms, and I've seen probably 24 of them in my career, none of these have made the slightest difference in the outcomes of the schools where a vicious code of discipline takes the place of anything like democratic learning. The refusal of the powerful, the powers that be, and I don't mean simply political conservatives, but also the refusal of too many timid liberals to what I call semi-liberals, to batter down the walls between two separate worlds of education has resulted in what I call the routine amputation of potential in millions of our most vulnerable children. And I began by teaching in a classic segregated school, and I've probably visited in more than 100 similar schools all over the country, but I also visit the good suburban schools for contrast. And while the children in the best suburban schools are allowed to learn out of a healthy appetite for learning, to pursue their curiosities, and to ask discerning questions, the children with whom I've been working in the inner city schools are all too often compelled to learn out of a sense of fear of failure and fear of punishment. And in my book, as you've already seen, I describe, some of the draconian punishments that most Americans appear not to want to recognize. Lockdown rooms, for example, for minor misbehaviors for little kids. I walked into a segregated school in Boston where a child who misbehaved in the most limited way with no danger to anyone, who just slowed down the pace of learning, was put in a storage closet in the hallway. They euphemistically called it the calm down room. But lockdowns aren't the worst. Physical abuse is shockingly common. Corporal punishment is still allowed in 23 states. Perhaps the worst is the frequency of juvenile arrest, of calling in the police on a child who might be only 6 years old, 7 years old. And I describe little girl in Orlando, Florida, a black child who was six, and she had a mild tantrum in class, which in a good school could be dealt with by a counselor, a psychologist. Instead, they call in the police, and he puts her in, what do you call those things, wrist ties, and drags her off to a detention center. So just to finish up my point about these cycles of reform that come and go, the latest one is phonics. We rediscovered phonics as a magic answer to all our problems about 2 years ago. But that's just one example of what I mean. Things like A Nation at Risk, No Child Left Behind, Common Core, etc. The intention of these efforts is somehow to prove that separate need not be unequal, that you can have good separate schools. I call it the search for perfectible apartheid. Yeah. And a term that a lot of people don't like. The point is, it hasn't worked. Are you familiar with the work of Nicole Hannah-Jones?
Oh, yeah, I've read some of her.
Hannah-Jones is a writer for the New York Times. And in an interview, she was asked, if these reforms don't work, what does work? And she answered with a single word, and that word was integration. And it's possible. I mean, it's not unthinkable even today in America. Here in Boston, I mentioned this in the book, here in the Boston area, there's a spectacularly successful but little known integration program in which thousands of Black and Latino kids from the city, from segregated sections of the city, ride the bus to more than 30 terrific, well-funded suburban districts. And the results are remarkable, unheard of statistics in the inner city. The 95% of the kids in the program graduate from high school in 4 years. And virtually all of them go on to four-year colleges. So it's, you know, even by the standards of the toughest standards, measurable standards, they're achieving at a level that's virtually unheard of in the inner city. And the program is also very carefully curated in order to be sure that it never subtracts from the racial identity of the children.
Right.
That respects their racial identity. So that's a summary of where I stand right now.
Yeah.
And just, you know, to make one more point, you would think that people would look at this kind of program. This is not a foreign country. Massachusetts is a little more liberal than the rest of the nation, but you would think that people would look at this and say, well, let's replicate that. Let's do that elsewhere. But political leaders in Washington have refused to see this kind of program as a model for the nation. Why? Because it requires busing. And busing is a scare word for ambitious politicians. President Biden, sad to say, had a powerful role ever since his Senate years in placing a stigma on that word. Today, he says, he claims he believes in integration, but he's still opposed to one and only way by which to make it possible. And, you know, he's cumulatively, I hate to say this, but cumulatively over the years, he has done more harm to the cause of integration than even the overtly racist Donald Trump. You know, I'll still vote for Biden, of course.
Yeah.
Inevitably, but not without a sense of shame that we have no more ennobled choices.
Right.
More visionary choices. Are you a literature major?
No.
You're not. But are you familiar at all with the great Irish poet William Butler Yeats?
I haven't read much Yeats.
Well, Yeats is one of his most famous comments on political life is, quote, the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity.
I've certainly heard that quote, yeah.
I can't think of a better description of the choice we have in the election next fall.
Yeah.
So now shut up and let you have a question.
Yeah. So you've laid out with some passionate intensity there, you know, some of the horrors that we inflict on children, the, as you say, the amputation of potential and the stark differences between the schools that are given to our poorest children, particularly Black and Latino children, and the schools that more affluent white children go to. You have, in the course of your career, visited many, many schools at both ends of the spectrum. And one of the things I was hoping you could answer was, you've described a little bit about what happens in the worst schools, these punitive measures. But if we're thinking about the kind of schools that embody what you said there, this ideal of democratic learning, what is it that makes for, in your observations of all these schools, what makes a good school? What is the kind of school that every child should be entitled to?
Okay. I would start by saying a school in which all the children are allowed to take some joy in learning, where they're not compelled to swallow the accepted verities, and where they can laugh and smile and whisper to each other or look out the window at a squirrel without the sword of punishment above their heads that their teacher's going to say, as I hear in inner city schools, like, Shaniqua, you're in red zone, meaning some kind of bad place in the teacher's estimation. Also a school where children are not perceived as just so many little economic units to be groomed to find their place in the corporate society, but are given the tools they're going to need to thrive and flourish through their adult years as creative citizens, as citizens above all else, and clear thinking citizens. Finally, I would say a school where wonderful teachers are not compelled to give up all their autonomy and suppress their personalities in order to conform to what I call a standardized banality. Quick example, here in Massachusetts, there's an industrial town called Lawrence. And Lawrence is, the students there, almost all are either Dominican or Puerto Rican or else Black. And here's a classic situation. I've seen this elsewhere, but a sixth grade teacher, her classroom is invaded by three so-called experts from a private foundation, a private corporation, were brought into the school in order to stiffen up the behavior of the teachers, get them to be more stern and didactic with the children. So they're sitting in the back of her classroom and she has to wear an earpiece so they can talk to her while she's teaching. And they tell her, you look too happy. You're smiling too much. Don't move from leg to leg. She's told to stand in something called mountain pose. And one of the little boys in her class, you know, notices the earpiece. And he says, what's that thing you're wearing in your ear? And the experts tell her, don't answer him. And when he asks it again, they say, give him a detention. At that point, the little boy is wondering. I love kids who politely audacious. The boy stands up and he says to her, to the teacher, he says, don't listen to them. Listen to me.
Yeah.
You're a person, teacher. Be a person. Be you. I love that. He said, be you. He said, I'm a person. You're a person too. Be you. Love that. And but that's just an example of the kind of this sort of business-driven trend, this corporate trend that's driving good teachers out of the classroom. Because who wants to teach? Most of the wonderful teachers I know, and I know a lot of them, they didn't come into education out of a wish to be a classroom cop. They want to seed the lives of their children with exhilaration and joy and humor about learning. And there are plenty of great teachers, but I'm sure you're familiar with the fact that there's a terrible flight of teachers now from our public schools.
Yeah. And so one of the primary targets of your criticism here is the kind of method that emphasizes obedience, regimentation, quantification. You point out that, you know, when you started teaching, there were, the wisdom was something like that, you know, that slogan, like, every day we must obey. And they don't say it quite that explicitly now, but they devise all sorts of other systems, sometimes which are very complicated, like when you describe the various levels of conversation that are allowed, or the misbehavior tax, all these kinds of bureaucratic language where the entire purpose is to regiment and discipline the children.
Yeah, in one case, there's a another one of these business, these corporate foundations, which are coming into the public schools. I call it the corporate invasion. They're coming in as alleged experts. And one of them had this thing about levels of permissible conversation for children. There was level one, level two, level three. I think level four was like regular speech, regular conversation, which was forbidden. And in dining rooms, lunch rooms, where there might be six classes having lunch simultaneously, and no one is allowed to talk. Total rule of silence. One of the Harvard professors I know said she went and asked the principal of a school why they all had to be silent. He said, it's to give them a rest in the middle of the day, something like that. And she said facetiously, it didn't seem much like a rest. It seemed more like a prison. And then I go out to a nice, normal suburb within 20 minutes of Boston, in a town like the one where I grew up, which is sort of an upper-middle-class suburb. And it's fun to come into the classroom. The kids look forward to Monday morning. I mean, not all of them, but most of them. They look forward to what's going to happen Monday morning. And the teachers are relaxed. They're not uptight. There's not... In the inner city, I often feel that teachers are trained to see the children as adversaries, as though the kids are the enemies of the state.
Yeah.
To borrow from Orwell, forgive me for citing so many European authors, but that's my background. I majored in English Lit at Harvard.
You're listening to the Current Affairs podcast from Current Affairs Magazine in New Orleans, Louisiana. Current Affairs is a registered 501c3 nonprofit organization, and we depend entirely on reader subscriptions and donations. You'll notice we have no ads, no mattresses, no recruiters, no sports betting. If you can help us in our mission to build independent progressive media, please visit currentaffairs.org/donate to make a donation, or currentaffairs.org/subscribe to subscribe to our beautiful print magazine. Thank you so much for supporting our work. Now, back to the program.
Well, you know, one of the arguments that would be made in favor of the kind of punitive approach is that we have to have harsh discipline, or these zero tolerance or no excuses policy, because this is the foundation of learning, and that actually children succeed more when you have this kind of regimentation. But what you're pointing out there is that in these other schools, these affluent schools, this is not the approach to take it. The best schools that you have visited do not treat the children like they're prisoners to be controlled.
Absolutely. That's the point. You know, the no excuses ethos, to me, it's just incompatible with the best virtues of the United States of America, if we would simply honor those virtues. No excuses education sounds like Stalinist Russia or Germany, maybe in the 1930s. It's an intolerant cruelty. And it's not just it's no excuses, but it's no independent thinking. That's the point. They're like, as if they're afraid to let the children interrogate reality. And I use that term because it's not merely to ask questions about, like, you know, why why is the sky blue? But to challenge the world in which we grow up in order to be a part of its transformation when we're adults. And, I worry about having a generation of voters who are trained to absolute obedience. What do they do when they're faced with tyrannical leaders? Anyway, a month or two ago, the New York Times sent a reporter up to Cambridge to interview me. And she actually did a very nice and favorable portrait of my book and my career. And I was grateful. But one thing in one moment stands out in my memory. The reporter asked me, why do I need to use scathing terms like apartheid education instead of more moderate and conciliatory language? And I'm sure others will ask that as well. All my life, I've been asked that kind of question. But to be honest, especially at my present age, I just don't have time to steer away from accurate and forceful words. There was a great New Englander, one of the most famous abolitionists. His name was William Lloyd Garrison. And he was white. A white man lived in a town north of Boston. And, you know, ultimately the most important abolitionist was Frederick Douglass. But Garrison helped to set the way. And somebody said to him once, "Why, William, you are all on fire." And he answered, "I have need to be on fire. There are mountains of ice about me I must melt." Well, I wouldn't dare compare myself to Garrison, but I thought that was in the good American spirit of independent thinking. I don't think that was subversive, you know. Or if it was subversive of slavery, then that was a good time to be subversive.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're certainly, Garrison said he would be as harsh as truth. And I think that that's, you know, you're not going to get the question around here, because I believe very strongly that, you know, injustice should make you angry. The first time I went to the campus of, I think it was Phillips Andover in Massachusetts, I was giving a talk, and it made me angry because I saw how lovely it was. It was like the Harvard Yard, and it was a high school. And I wasn't angry at the kids there. They were really nice. But when you realize that the spectrum of what a school, what the experience of school is like, runs from going to something that is as lovely as the Harvard Yard, essentially, at some of these private schools, to something that really is, as you point out, basically indistinguishable from prisons, or perhaps even worse than some prisons. I mean, you document the way that children are poisoned at some of these schools that are in disrepair. I mean, children, the toxins at these schools, the buildings falling apart, bathrooms that they won't even let the adults go in because they're so disgusting that when you visit the schools, they go, no, use the guest bathroom. Don't use this bathroom. And to do that to children.
That's right. I describe schools that are not just ugly, decrepit, which is bad enough, because that sours the mentalities of children, but where lead paint is crumbling from the walls and ceilings. And, you know, we've known for five, six generations, we've known certainly since the 1970s that lead paint exposure, when children breathe it or in some cases chew the flakes of that it does irreversible damage often to their cerebral function. And there's no way to ever make up for that later on, because once that happens, that year of your life is gone forever. You're never going to get that year again to live in a healthier environment, to study in a place that's not going to damage you. I've never seen that. I've never seen flaking lead paint poison in the good suburban schools I visit. It's not just that they're respectful of the children's basic elemental health and safety, but they spend enough money so that it's a charming place. It's a likable place, not unlike the school you mentioned, Andover. Phillips Academy, which I know very well, and Exeter, its rival school, and Groton, and similar of the exceptionally well-known and justly famous prep schools attended by generations of privileged people. And, you know, and some of these private schools, they're willing to spend the money not just to make the school building attractive, but they often have art galleries with priceless art. I mean, not simply galleries for the children's art, but for, you know, for classic works that graduates probably donate to the school. I say this because the old question that I've been asked ever since I started teaching in 1964, the old question I've always been asked by conservatives is the following: does money really matter in determination of a good school? And I always say, of course it does. If it didn't matter, why do you think, I specifically say this, why do you think that schools like Andover, where the children of presidents go to school, are willing to spend so much money to create a stimulating and often beautiful environment? I often say that, you know, ugly settings cheapen the souls of children. Beautiful environments refine their souls. So there's two worlds of education in America. And I'm getting pretty old, but to my dying day, I'm not going to give up on this struggle.
Yeah, and it seems to me that, you know, underlying one of the values underlying your work is this belief that the worst off children, the poorest children, they deserve the best as well, that nobody that nobody should be given up on, and that in fact, if anything, we should spend more on the children who have the least, because those are the ones who have the most obstacles to overcome. The children of presidents, you know, might need to be invested in a little less. Now, I want to turn to what, you know, the path forward. You mentioned busing programs, which you've given a sort of central importance to, letting children go to the best schools. But I mean, surely that can only be a partial solution, because ultimately we want all schools to be brought up to the level of the best.
Yes, that's true. And I won't go off in a long detour about this, but I'm determined, I've always at least urged political allies here in Massachusetts and other states, not simply to expand a one-way busing program from the city to the suburbs, but to develop at least a ring of spectacular magnet schools on the edges of the inner city, which are so good that kids will be eager to make the ride in reverse. Essentially, to create what I would call a metropolitan school district, which might include as many as 25 districts, including the inner city itself. And in cities like Boston or New York or Chicago, but I'll just speak for Boston because this is where I live, with all its world-class medical facilities, health research, scientific labs, and extraordinary museums. Imagine what it would be like if you created a school that was identified with one of those institutions, like, you know, the Massachusetts General Hospital School of Life Science. I think with ingenuity and imagination and ethical audacity, we could crack open this hardened shell of racial isolation. It wouldn't be so hard. It would take a president who has the president and a Congress, but especially I'm thinking of presidential leadership that would authorize, not more than authorize, that would even devote the huge amount of funding it would take to make this a reality. And one of the, as I said, I knew enough about Joe Biden's background. I mean, I met him when he was in the Senate. He once invited me to his home to give a talk to his neighbors. Yes. He probably will think I'm not grateful now. But that was before I knew much about his politics. He invited me to his home to give a talk on adult literacy because his wife was a volunteer. And he's a very nice man. He gave me cookies and milk, as I recall, sitting in his kitchen afterwards with him. But and he is likable. That's the trouble, because he's likable, but there's something ethically missing. And I just hope someday we'll have another president, maybe with the leadership, and a president who's as high-minded as FDR, for example. I hark back to Franklin Roosevelt, partly because I can remember the day he died. I'm old enough, so I remember that day. I remember my mother crying in the kitchen. But I don't want to get lost in nostalgia. I think this is a great country, and I think we deserve great leadership.
Well, I was just looking back at another old book of yours, which is called Children of the Revolution, a Yankee teacher in the Cuban schools. And one of the things you talk about there is that Cuba, after the Cuban Revolution, you know, sort of made a commitment to literacy, a national commitment. And for whatever serious criticisms we might have of Castro's Cuba, they took, you know, the idea that every child deserves an education was taken seriously. And there's a massive national project. And you point out that in the United States, you point out in this book, we've never said, you know, okay, we're going to embark on a collective mission to make sure that every child has their basic needs met, has their basic rights fulfilled. And there have been lots of promises of, oh, we're going to invest in building schools. And then somehow it always gets cut from the legislation and put to the wayside.
Typically what happens is they appoint a commission to look into the matter.
Yeah.
To look into the matter of unequal funding, or to look into the matter of lead paint, inner city school. And the commission then is given 10 years to come up with a report or something like that. That's kind of a classic urban political ritual. The thing is, we don't need to look to Cuba. There are plenty of other nations where the education of children, particularly very young children, is a very high priority. France, for example. It's just embarrassing that in the United States, for almost since I was a teacher, we have successive presidents or candidates have promised that if they're elected, we will have universal preschool, universal Head Start. And every one of them has broken that promise right up to the present day. A million kids are still excluded. So I'm going to be 88 in the fall. And I don't expect to live long enough to see the transformations that for which I've struggled over the past 60 years. What I hope is that a younger generation of thoughtfully rebellious young people, students and their teachers, will carry on the torch.
And I certainly hope that a lot of them are going to pick up your new book, The Statement of Your Fundamental Critique, which does in fact embody the Garrisonian dictum to be as harsh as truth and as uncompromising as justice, and on certain subjects to not speak or write with moderation when there is cause for severity. You lay out, as you have for us today, a searing indictment of the cruelty of apartheid schooling in America. The book is available from the New Press. Jonathan Kozel, thank you so much for joining us on Current Affairs today.
Thank you, Nathan. It was a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
The Current Affairs podcast is a product of Current Affairs magazine. If you are not subscribed to Current Affairs magazine, visit currentaffairs.org/subscribe today and get our glorious print edition. The Current Affairs podcast is released regularly every week on patreon.com/currentaffairs. Thanks for listening.